You better come on in my kitchen. There's hard to be raining out door.
Come over here, kid. Where's up? You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of oil. You fry some garlic. And you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. You got it to a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? And a little bit of wine. A little bit of sugar.
Delicious.
And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a bigger pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce. Mashed potatoes,
yeah. I eat with gusto, damn your bet, my country, tis of thee. I eat for social progress, I eat for victory.
Delicious.
Stay hungry, stay hungry, stay hungry.
Well, I'm hungry, how about you? Good evening. It is Michelle Anna Jordan live in the studio here on Mouthful. Hope you've had a good weekend. This fall weather is just so gorgeous, isn't it? Farmers Market was lovely today, the Sebastopol Farmers Market. I'm sure they all were. It's the only one I got to today, and you know, there are still tomatoes. There's still zucchini. There's still sweet peppers and hot peppers, and they're all starting to overlap with fall vegetables and fruit. Winter squash, I saw the very first chestnuts at the market today, and there was quince, too, and that's part of what we're talking about tonight. We're talking about quince from my very own tree with KRCB's own Laura Hager-Rush with a really exciting new project, Sonoma Aperitif. Welcome to Mouthful.
Hi, thanks so much.
It's hard to believe you actually haven't been here before.
It is, except remember I used to do book reviews for
you. That's right. You did fabulous book reviews. So you were represented on the station, but you pre-recorded them. You weren't live in the studio.
So this is exciting.
Yeah, you did really great reviews. I miss those. And thank you for doing them.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you have started Sonoma Aperitif.
I have. I think it's the newest winery in Sonoma County right now. I just got my license in March.
So it's actually a winery.
It is actually a winery. To make aperitifs, you actually need a winemaker's license.
Oh, really? Oh, interesting. And tell us about the location where your tasting room is, because it is just such a treasure.
Great. Our tasting room is on the border of Petaluma and Pengrove. It's in what used to be the old Eagle Ridge Winery, and that now houses two wineries, my winery, Sonoma Aperitif, and Scoggins Wines as well.
Now, Scoggins, I've never heard of.
He's brand new. He's been making wine at various places for about 12 years, and this is his first launch into having his own winery.
Uh-huh. Cool. I know I went to a little party there, and it's just such a wonderfully historic place that you just feel like you're in old Sonoma County.
Absolutely. It was the original creamery built for Petaluma. The building, the winery was built in 1887, and there are houses on the property that were built in 1862.
And are they occupied?
They are.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's great. So tell us about Sonoma Aperitif. How long have you been working on this project?
I've been working on this project for about 2 years. About 4 years ago, maybe 3 years ago, I was at a friend's house, and she said, oh, let me show you this fun thing that my husband and I have been making in our garage. And they brought out all these bottles, actually all these mason jars.
Of course.
And they said, you know, give it a shot. It's probably something you've never had before. And I tasted several of them. I thought, oh, well, these were, you know, they're interesting. And then I tasted one that they'd made with bergamot. And it was one of those transcendent beverage experiences.
I just said, for people who don't know, that's a citrus.
That is a citrus. It's a sour, bitter orange, mostly grown along the Adriatic. And I thought, wow, why have I never tasted this before? Like, why have I never tasted this type of beverage before?
What could you compare it to that people might have had?
Probably the thing that it is most like would be the French apéritif called Lillet.
That's what, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It's Lillet is actually a part of the same tradition that Sonoma apéritif is doing, mm-hmm. which is a 700-year-old winemaking tradition from rural France. And there are a lot of apéritifs also from Italy made like this. I actually get a fair amount of visitors from Italy into the tasting room, which is really fun. It's somehow gotten through the grapevine
that
apéritifs like home are made here.
Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah.
I think for a lot of people, they don't necessarily, if they haven't had Lillet or something comparable to Lillet, they don't really know. Like, is an apéritif a liqueur? Is it high alcohol? Is it low alcohol? So let's sort of set it in the context of those before and after dinner drinks.
Absolutely. So this particular type of apéritif is relatively low in alcohol. The grapefruit apéritif that I have right now is about 15.9%, which is just a little bigger than a Big Zin, and that's because of the there's some very little fortification involved in the making of this type of apéritif. It's not particularly sweet. It's not kind of cloying the way people often think of apéritifs, and they expect something that sort of
limoncello, for example.
Exactly.
Which is like you could pour it on pancakes, but you might not want to drink it at the end of the night.
Exactly. This isn't at all like this. It's extremely refreshing, and the mm-hmm. whole idea of it is to really deliver the essence of seasonal fruit. Mm-hmm. And so that was my plan from the very start, was to create seasonal apéritifs.
Mm-hmm. And how many have you made so far?
Well, how many have I tested?
What have you tested?
Probably tested about 60 different combinations.
Uh-huh.
And I've decided to do 4 major releases for each of the seasons. Mm-hmm. And then within that, I'll do sort of smaller, unusual heirloom mm-hmm. Combinations. And then I'll also do, I think I'm going to produce grapefruit year-round because people seem to like it so much.
It's my favorite so far of the ones I've tasted probably 4 or 5,
you
I guess.
Have, yeah.
And I liked them all, but I loved the grapefruit. So how does that start? How do you make it?
You basically take a still wine. You can use Sauvignon Blanc, Pinot Grigio. I hear that Sonoma Port Works is making something similar using a Chardonnay.
Don't do that. make it for the rest of us.
That's all right. Right. Exactly. So I find it works to use a sort of crisp, high acidic white. And you then add a little bit of fortification. You can use any type of hard alcohol.
So like brandy, vodka?
I use a grape-based vodka.
Okay.
I like the clean. I've actually done some experimenting with brandies, mm-hmm. And they tasted too brandy-like.
Yeah, they taste like brandy.
I liked the clean.
Sure.
Oddly enough, even when you taste them plain, they don't taste like vodka. They don't taste like brandy. It's when you mix them with the fruit that brandiness comes out and bugged me. I like the clean taste of the vodka.
Mm-hmm.
And because of federal and state regulations, it has to be a grape-based vodka.
That's interesting. Yeah. And then, now, are you making that wine as well?
I am not making that wine white right now. Mm-hmm. This year, I actually do, since I have an O2 winemaking license, I have to ferment 50% of the wine that I sell. So I will be making it this
uh-huh.
year with the help of another winemaker.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Yeah. And then so you start with a still high acid still wine.
Mm-hmm. You add a little fortification. You can add as much, you can add sweetening if you want. Classic recipes actually just call for sugar, plain white sugar, mm-hmm. and that is actually my preference.
Uh-huh.
It's not legal to use that when you make apéritifs in California.
Oh, what do you have to use?
I sadly have been told. So I have readjusted my recipes using grape, varietal grape concentrate.
Oh.
There are many states in the United States that allow you to use sugar mm-hmm. in wines, and this is considered a wine mm-hmm. product, so restaurants that only have a beer and wine license
can sell
this. But California is one of those states that forbids you to use for using cane sugar.
Probably because they don't want to make the designation between the apéritifs and then putting in a standard wine to increase the alcohol.
Ah, yeah, interesting.
I mean, that's what I would think.
I always wondered about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that's controversial, but supposedly it's done a lot. There's a word for it.
Chapelization.
Yeah, and it's supposedly done a lot in France, and it's frowned upon, but people do it anyway.
Right.
So I bet it has something to do with that.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And with the lack of understanding.
That is absolutely the idea.
And also with the lack of understanding of what an aperitif is.
Exactly.
So now you're official now, and people come to your tasting. When did the tasting room open?
We're open by appointment only. I'm usually there on weekend afternoons, and anytime anyone calls me up on my phone, since I work nearby, I can be there soon.
And have you started selling yet?
I haven't started selling yet. I just got my label approval on Friday.
Wow, congratulations.
Very excited. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Do you have a copy of the label? Because we'll hold it up to the microphone so people can see it.
I thought that would be very clear. People can see it on the Sonoma Aperitif blog. They can see the grapefruit label. And I also got approval for a quince and star anise, which is one of my favorite winter aperitifs. So that's what your quinces will be used in.
Quince and star anise together?
Exactly.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. You know what? We're going to take a little musical break here. We will be right back. It's Mouthful. It's Michelle Jordan. We had to take that fast little musical break because I had to cough. I had this little scratchy thing in my throat all day. You just poured off mic. You poured a couple of enchanting looking things. So, which one are we going to try first?
Why don't we start with the Japanese yuzu aperitif?
Now, yuzu is
A Japanese citrus.
How'd you get it?
It looks like a pomelo. And where I got it was I got it from an acquaintance's backyard in Sunnyvale.
Wow, that's great. I just threw away a bottle. I had a bottle of yuzu vinegar.
Ah.
And I just practically used an eyedropper. And it's like, okay, it's gone now. Yeah. I can't squeeze the bottle anymore.
They're hard to get a hold of.
Oh, wow. Now I think I like this one better even than the grapefruit.
That's so interesting.
It has that forward spark that you get from particularly lemon.
Right, absolutely.
And I love citrus.
And yuzu is really sort of the lemon of Japan.
Mm-hmm. Mm. That is really good. Really, really good.
Fond of that one.
Now, they're going to be called Sonoma Aperitif.
They are.
Will they have other sort of proprietary names?
They will. So, interestingly enough, the federal government does not consider these aperitifs because they have fruit in them. So, while my company is called Sonoma Aperitif, on the spur of the moment, they said, make up a different name for your product.
Really?
They did. They did.
So an aperitif is not supposed to have fruit?
In the United States, understanding of what an aperitif is, you're only supposed to have spices and herbs. I guess they just missed out on this whole multi-century tradition of fruit-based aperitifs. Right, exactly. So that was startling. And in a fit of pique, but also because I like the phrase, I called them, their branded name is Qu'est-ce que c'est? So grapefruit Qu'est-ce que c'est? It's French.
And they let you do that?
They did. It's French for what is it?
Uh-huh.
Because I figured...
It's one of my favorite expressions. I use it all the time.
It sounds so great in your mouth, qu'est-ce que c'est?
That is so funny. You can call them that, but labeling in America.
I know.
It's fascinating. So
what's the label says, grapefruit qu'est-ce que c'est? A wine specialty product vented and bottled by Sonoma Aperitif.
Wow. That's amazing. What size batches do you make?
I generally make... at this point, I'm just starting out, so I'm starting out with small batches, 5-gallon carboys, basically.
Okay. And then you're bottling them. Is that a three? That's not a three. Is it a 375?
This is a 375.
There's a 375. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And is that going to be the standard size for that?
Size.
Okay.
Exactly.
Great. Now, there's something else you poured, and it's probably the first way I tried them. You put something in a bigger glass, and then you added my favorite beverage in the world, sparkling wine.
I did. So this is a little strawberry and basil aperitif with some sparkling wine. And the interesting thing is, I think you can take a pretty ordinary, no name shall be used, a pretty ordinary sparkling wine, and the aperitif makes it interesting and different.
It's lovely. It's lovely. I'm trying to see if I can identify the strawberry. Yeah, there it is.
Yeah. In this particular one, the basil's pretty forward. This is Laos strawberry from outside of Sebastopol.
Uh-huh. Oh, right. Yes. They have the best strawberries. They're so good
there. They are good.
It's on Highway 12 as you're headed into Santa Rosa. Big sign. How much? So if you've got the 5-gallon poor boys, not that we want you to give away your recipes or anything, but how much fruit needs to go in for you to get the level of extraction you want?
About 25%.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And when you say doing something like yuzu or grapefruit, are you using the zest, the skin, the whole fruit, or what?
I use the zests. I supreme out the fruit. Mm-hmm. And I throw some peel in there. I mean, I throw some pith in there just for the bitter quality.
Uh-huh. And then what happens to the fruit?
Then, this is the second fun part of my business, after I rack the wine, after it infuses for several weeks, after I rack the wine off of the fruit, I take the fruit and I turn it into jams and preserves.
Really?
I do.
Oh, wow, that's so cool.
I know, I'm excited about this. In fact, I have some right
here
for you to try.
Yes, and you're going to tell us about it because it came from a very special place.
A very special place being the quince tree in your backyard. It's a ginger quince jam.
Really good.
And I can just
talk on the radio with your mouth full. This is the
that's
problem
why,
with this
That's
particular.
Why we call it mouthful.
Right. That's really funny.
You did my quince justice.
Yay, I'm very glad because you have beautiful quince. Mm. They're, Michelle has a beautiful European quince tree in her backyard.
And I have 5 trees.
Really?
I planted that.
I noticed the little one.
Yeah, well, I planted that. It was just this tiny thing. Planted it largely because gophers don't eat it.
That's fascinating.
They don't eat that. You can plant it directly in the ground. So I planted it, and it got huge. And one day, somebody's working on my yard for me, and he was really good with trees. And there were so many, you know, offshoots that I had him just separate out 4 or 5 and plant them. So I now have a small quince orchard.
Nice.
And you are welcome to them at any time.
So in addition to European quinces, the other, it's a type of, well, it's now called the pseudo quince. There's something called the Chinese quince, mm-hmm. which is this beautiful kind of yellow oblong fruit. And I got it last year from Luther Burbank Farms. Mm-hmm. They had a tiny little basket full of them at the farmer's market, and I'm hoping to snag some more of them this year because they're hard to come by, in my experience. They look like a papaya. They have...
interesting.
They have, when you open them up, they have those little round seeds like a papaya has, but they taste almost identical to a European quince, and for years... people considered that these were the two types of quinces in the world, and then as genetic analysis became more sophisticated, they discovered that, in fact, they were not related at all.
At all. Interesting.
So it's now... So, of course, because of ethnocentricity, mm-hmm. among other things, mm-hmm. The Chinese quince was demoted to a pseudo-quince.
That's hilarious. What was it? No, that one was a berry that you just gave me.
That was a blackberry. That's a black a Tibetan blackberry with a blackberry aperitif.
So you take the you take fresh blackberries as well as some that have been...
I do. So I take some fruit that's been macerating in the wine, and then I add additional fresh fruit as well. Mm-hmm.
And you'll be selling this with...
I will be.
Cool.
Indeed.
Cool. Now tell us about the one with the sparkling wine. What's the oh no, this we already did this. This is the strawberry and basil.
Strawberry. We did that.
Don't let the girl have any more. It's really, really quite lovely. Now, you say it's a 700-year-old tradition, so I imagine that there's some great stuff in literature, French literature going back about these aperitifs.
It's pretty amazing, actually. They're probably derived from the spiced medicinal wines of the early Middle Ages. And they became extremely popular in the 17th and 18th centuries. And some of the people who wrote about them are, Casanova mentions them in his memoirs. He mentions that the court of Louis XV was completely mad for them.
Interesting. And did they talk about the infusions?
Absolutely. And if you look at old historic cookbooks, you'll find many recipes. For these.
I would imagine there's one out there, at least one out there, if not more, with rose petals.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And in fact, in summer, and I don't have any more right now, I make a white nectarine and roses with roses from my garden.
Yeah. Oh, nice. So white nectarine and roses. I would love to, if I were to do this, and I won't, I think I would like to do roses, cardamom, and black pepper.
Oh, that would be
really
interesting.
I think that would be really nice. Especially if you get... the world's best white pepper, and I know where it is.
Oh, you have to tell me where that is.
Yeah.
Because I actually tried a Meyer lemon black pepper infusion. Uh-huh. It was one of the very first I tried, and the acridness of the black pepper came out in an unfortunate way.
Oh, that's too bad. Well, the best, I'm sure I've talked about this. Haven't I talked about this on Mouthful before, Mike? The best black pepper in the world. It is on the island of Borneo and the Malaysian state of Sarawak. It is made in Bing Tagore, and what they're doing there is it's made by the Pepper Marketing Board, which is just a horrible name because they actually produce. They were trying to find a way to do a value added to their peppercorns to sort of mitigate the situation of peppercorns rising and falling in 10-year cycles. So what they did was, and there were at the time I visited. In 98, there were 40,000 small peppercorn farms in the state of Sarawak, most with about 300 vines. And so what they were doing was paying the farmers a premium if they got the peppercorns to them within 24 hours of picking. Because usually they dry them in the yard, the chickens are running through them, kids are riding bicycles through them, grandma's, you know, raking. Grandma's raking, and birds are flying over, and they get salmonella and E. coli, and then almost all the peppercorns in the world, especially those that come into the United States, are sterilized with ethylene oxide and irradiated. And the first thing that happens with those kinds of peppercorns is the bacteria degrades the higher notes. And then the ethylene oxide and the irradiation process further degrade the higher notes. And so you end up with something that tastes like all the pepper you've ever tasted.
Right.
But when you taste peppercorn that has been, because they get it within 24 hours, and within another 24 hours, it is ready for the market. And it has, in addition to the flavors you would expect, has all of these high notes. So you see me wiggling my hands. They're very floral and almost sweet.
Oh, that would be wonderful. We should talk about a source for those.
I'm working on it. I have been trying since Penzi bought 40 tons of it, and they're sold out, and they haven't gotten any more. And so for about 2 years, I've been trying to find a source, and I think I'm getting closer. But because of the sweetness, I mean, it's really... It's sweet and pungent, and it's just beautiful. Just absolutely gorgeous. I'm on a mission.
I can tell that.
to excite people like you about these peppercorns so we can get them. I have one jar left. I mean, I would buy 10 pounds at a time.
Wow.
And just give them away and then use, you know, I was using a lot. And I have one pint jar half full, and I keep it next to my desk. And when I need some extra motivation, I just open it and breathe it in. And it's like, yes, I'm not crazy. It really is this different. Anyway.
You're making me so want to try that.
Yes, good. Between us, we've got the new spice guy. Someone you should probably know because of the quality of his spices. He has the local spicery.
Ah.
He sells every other week at the, and his name is Nick. Please, I think it's
at the Sebastopol Farmers Market.
Yes.
I've met him.
Yeah, he's great. And he just told me today that because I've been begging him since I met him to find this pepper.
Uh-huh.
And he has 15 samples of pepper coming in. So
nice.
We'll see. We will get there. If I have to find a way to get back to Malaysia and get that pepper, I will.
You could become the importer.
There we go. Oh, gosh. There's a headache for you. Okay, so what's next?
What's next? Well, I'm just about to have our opening party, which is going to be the first weekend of November.
First and second?
First and second.
First and second.
Yeah.
I only know that because of Halloween. You know, it's Halloween.
Right. Oh, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so tell me about the party. Is it
about
public? Is it public or is it invitation?
It is by invitation.
Oh, okay.
Only.
So it's we don't need to tell everybody about it.
Exactly.
Okay. And then when
if you're a wine club member at Sonoma Aperitif, you will certainly be invited.
Oh, so you already have a wine club? People can sign up?
I do. I have a wine club. I established a wine club early on as a way of helping fund the creation of the winery.
Oh, wow. That's really smart.
Yeah. It was actually the P.W. Scoggins, the guy who's sharing my space, had that idea. And it's worked out really well. So a lot of people took out memberships as sort of founder members.
Uh-huh. Is that something people can still do?
Absolutely. If you go on my website, you can definitely do that.
SonomaAperitif.com?
SonomaAperitif.com.
Great. How cool.
It's a cool thing. And I'll tell you a fun... At the highest level, there's a $100 wine club, which you get a bottle of aperitif and a jar of aperitif jam every season. There's a $250 level. And at the $500 level, not only do you get two bottles of aperitif and two jars of jam every month...
Every month.
You also get to come and stay at the winemaker's, my glorious abode, in Forestville.
Well, that's okay. So how many members do you think you have?
I have about 20.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
How cool.
It's a fun thing.
Yeah, that's really great. We're going to take another musical break here on Mouthful, and we'll be right back with more talk about, delicious aperitifs.
Thank you. for trouble and I found it, son. Straight down the barrel of the lawman's gun. I try to run, but I don't think I can. You make one move and you're a dead man. Friend, I ain't living long. An early death. All I remember was a drunk man's breath. Ain't living long.
It's Mouthful. We are talking with Laura Hager, founder of Sonoma Aperitif. Oh, you should just see the beautiful colors of everything. One of the things I love about quince, it's white, off-white a little bit if you cut into the fruit. When you cook it in any way, when you do anything to it, it just turns the nicest shade of deep, rich pink.
Absolutely. This beautiful sort of orangish pink.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really lovely. Yeah. So you poured something else in my glass.
I did. This is an heirloom citrus aperitif. It's a combination of yuzu, Moro blood orange, and Owari tangerine.
It's not to be repetitive, but it's also really good. And it's really integrated. You know, whereas the yuzu itself was just really forward on your palate.
Right.
This is just really round and integrated, and it's lovely.
I like
you're
this
doing a great job.
I like this particular blend.
Yeah, it's nice. When, traditionally, let's say, when was this drunk?
Traditionally, in France, where this particular tradition comes from, where it's called vin maison, it was an afternoon beverage. They had, in the way that the English have tea, around 3 or 4. In rural France, they would bring out
cocktails,
aperitif, and delicious little savory appetizers.
That's why I prefer France.
Yeah.
I mean, tea is fine. I love tea. But, you know, in the afternoon, bringing on, in fact,
bring
there's,
on
this, there's this woman, I can't think of her name right now, that my daughter knows. And she's French. She lives, I think, in Providence, Rhode Island, but they still have the family home back in Normandy. Mm-hmm. And Nicole knows her daughter and often visits. And every day at about 4 o'clock, she says in her French accent, which I cannot mimic, she says, okay, anyone under 18, out of my sight.
It's so funny.
And it's cocktail hour.
Absolutely. And so, but interestingly, so... you know, as industrialization has moved forward, even in France, aperitif hour, people are just working in the afternoon just like they're working here.
Yeah.
So aperitif hour has been moved forward. It's basically cocktail hour now. And so this particular style of aperitif is now just a before-dinner drink.
But yeah, before-dinner drink. That's what I thought. Yeah,
but also served with savory appetizers still, because mm-hmm. the balance between the slightly sweet and bitter with mm-hmm. the saltiness is just a sort
perfect.
Of perfect mix.
And I love that there's that very appealing edge of bitterness in all of these. You know, that cuts any potential for being cloying.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's really, it's something I try to be really careful about, because no one just wants to drink sweet wine in general. That's kind of revolting.
Well, if they do, we don't want to know them. if you, this might not be a fair question, but let's play.
Uh-huh.
If you were to make the quintessential Sonoma County aperitif, what do you think it would be?
What an interesting thought. So interestingly, I have not explored any apple-based aperitifs. Despite all the apples that we have, in part because some apple wines that I've tasted, I just haven't liked them very much. But would it be cliche to say I was thinking of trying a Gravenstein?
No, I don't think aperitif. I don't think that would be a cliche at all.
Yeah, absolutely. There are also some beautiful stone fruit aperitifs. Some Dry Creek Valley would be pretty
try
amazing.
Try it with our Arctic Gems.
Yeah.
That's like, to me...
Is that their white peach?
That's the white peach that ripens for 2 or 3 weeks in July.
Uh-huh.
And they always either call me or send me an email. It's ruined me. I love Arctic Gems so much. And for the last three years, it's been a really short season.
Uh-huh.
But it's the most voluptuous peach I've ever tasted.
Well,
it's
just
gorgeous.
All the most interesting heirloom fruits, I mean, they do have just kind of these heartbreakingly short seasons,
yeah.
you know, just like a
mm-hmm.
week. And if you miss it, I mean, bergamot has maybe a 2 week
uh-huh.
season.
Now, do you know anyone who grows it here?
No, and I wish I did. And if there is anyone who can hear me and you have a bergamot tree, we must talk.
Yeah, I'll give you a name off
Great.
The air, because I'm not sure if she does, but she might. I know that she gave me one a few years ago.
I'll tell you a funny story. So last year, after bergamot season ended and I wanted to make more bergamot aperitif, I couldn't find it anywhere. I called the Heirloom Plant Growers Association in the Bay Area
Good
and
idea.
Had them send out an email, and no one had it. You know, once the season is done, it's done. And then I happened to notice, as I was looking on Craigslist, I happened to notice in the free section that someone wrote, "Free weird citrus in my yard."
Oh, wow.
And they were in Santa Rosa. And I called them up and I said, well, what is it? She said, I have no idea. It's kind of like an orange. It's kind of like a lemon, but it's bitter and it's weird.
And you were already in your car driving by
the way. I was already in my car. I'm like, I'll take everything you've got. And I drove across Santa Rosa and I got to this person's house and there were all these bags and they were not bergamots. And I thought, what the heck is this? And she was right. It was half like an orange, half like a lemon. I took all the bags and I tasted them, and she was right. They were kind of bitter and sour, and I thought, what could this weird thing be? Turned out what she had were rangpores.
Oh, wow.
Exactly. So they made an incredibly delicious aperitif.
Uh-huh.
So if anyone has rangpores, which are also known as lamandarins, I would love to hear from you because I tried. I called her back this year. And remember that horrible freeze that we had? The one that
she
killed
lost it.
All the citrus trees in my yard?
Oh.
At least it died so far back that none of them were left.
Yeah. What about loquat and kumquat?
I have never tried. I've tried kumquats. I was not overly impressed by them, but I only tried one variety. And it's shocking, actually, the difference in the flavors in an infusion, since it really extracts the flavor so extremely. Between fruits that you would think are pretty similar, like different varieties of pears turn out wildly, wildly different. I kind of like star crimson pears to eat. And I thought, oh, this will make a lovely aperitif.
No.
It was terrible. It had this bizarre plastic flavor. It was...
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. While Bosque pears work beautifully, many types of Asian pears, Yali pears in particular.
Yali pears, I don't know.
That is a pretty unusual type of Asian pear. It's a Chinese pear. It looks like a Bartlett.
Oh.
But inside, it has the crispness of an Asian pear.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and they're, I'm going to be getting them this year from Gabriel Farms in Sebastopol. It's just the end of the season, and I'm getting the last few,
that's
I hear.
Great. What about pomegranates? Do they have any possibilities?
You know, I think they do have possibilities, but I haven't tried them yet. I'm a little worried. I'm not a, in part, maybe I'm not a big pomegranate fan.
Oh, and I am. I love them. So that's one of the first fruits I think of.
There's this fantastic book, sort of a self-published book, or actually a locally book.
Yeah, oh yeah, I know.
But the public, the, what was it called?
Oh, I'll think of it.
She Pomegranate also did, Path or something like that.
She also did Cartwheels on the Fault Line. She did several books that collected stories from women writers in the area.
Right, right.
I have a story in one of the books, maybe two of the books. And then she did a lot of research in Russia.
Right. That was a fascinating book, and we actually read that for my book group and had a pomegranate tasting. And they all tasted
the
like
same.
Various versions of pomegranate.
I think I write about pomegranate. I wrote about pomegranates for this week's
column. I should give it a try, though, actually. Yeah.
And there's a huge range.
You know, absolutely.
A really
white,
huge range.
White pomegranates. Black pomegranate.
Black?
Was amazing.
Black I don't know about.
Literally black, like purple black.
Where do I find those?
I believe that lovely woman who is the publisher has
Barbara.
Them growing in her backyard.
Is it Barbara Bear? B-A-E-R?
I think you might be right.
I think it's Barbara Bear.
Yeah. I think she has them growing in her backyard in Forestville.
Okay, like black pomegranates. Okay, there we go.
Yeah.
So do we have anything more to taste? Or do we just taste something
a second
time?
That is the end of the tasting. We can...
I
think we should add champagne
to the yuzu.
The yuzu.
Yes. You took the words right out of my mouth. Or I took them out of yours.
Do you spend every Sunday night like this?
I don't. Many Sunday nights lately, I'm at home at my computer.
There you go.
Okay, cool. Now, one thing, at what temperature do you want to serve these?
They should be served quite cold, right in the refrigerator. When people
this
buy
is a
my
winner.
Aperitifs,
usually with sparkling, definite winner.
When people buy my aperitifs, I tell them to take them and put them directly in the refrigerator.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't serve them over ice.
I wouldn't.
Because I know Lillet does that.
Exactly. I've actually I tried that.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that they just got too watery too fast.
Yeah,
in the same way
that
putting regular wine over ice, you really wouldn't do
I only put regular wine over ice. Well, never mind. Actually, it's a great way if you're forced to drink Chardonnay and you're not a fan of Chardonnay, put ice in it.
That'll do it.
Absolutely. Some Chardonnay maker is going to have me killed one of these days if I don't shut up. This is quite lovely with the yuzu. It really is very... They go together really well. And they... What's the right way to put it? It doesn't... It's very integrated. It makes the yuzu blossom in a certain way. It's like when I did my one official Scotch tasting in Scotland, I got to go on a press trip. And it was very interesting. You would taste it just straight in the glass, And then you would dilute it with a little water, not for the so much for the purpose of diluting it, but to see the way the water made it blossom.
How interesting.
Yeah. It was very counterintuitive. I thought, God, this stuff is really hot. I'll put water in and it'll calm down.
Right, right.
But no, it blossoms in, and you taste things that you don't taste when you're just sipping it straight.
Well, I can totally see why that would be true, basically because of the high alcohol sort of assaults your taste buds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But yeah. But more than that, it's making flavors within a well-made scotch. It's making those flavors blossom.
It's very
interesting. So the sparkling wine in the aperitif makes it blossom in a certain way.
It does bring out interesting floral notes.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
And I love floral notes. I want to go back to the jams and condiments that you're making, because I can't quite get my head around how that works. So you have the aperitif. They've been macerating with the fruit for about how long?
Depending on the fruit, it can be anywhere from 2 days.
Oh, really?
To 4 months.
What would take 2 days?
I did a hazelnut that only took 2 days. And in fact, what was really interesting is that it was delicious after 2 days. And I thought, ooh, I'm just going to leave it a few more days and it will be even more delicious. And I think I forgot about it for maybe, I don't know, a week. After which, it tasted like liquid peanut butter, which was so revolting.
Oh,
You can't even imagine it.
Wow.
So the timing is super important. Uh-huh. And one of the very long... So some of the aperitifs I make are traditional aperitifs with very long established history. The vin de pamplemousse, which is the grapefruit. Mm-hmm. It's a really common traditional aperitif in France. I also make a nocino.
Oh, you do?
Which is an infusion on green walnuts. Mm-hmm. You pick the walnuts before the shell has even formed in early June, when the shell is just this little white membrane around this little white fetal nut.
Yeah.
And you slash them. And that's actually one of the few that I make on a red wine.
Oh, out of red? Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Interesting.
And it's lovely.
Nocino. Oh, nocino can be so beautiful. Now, do you add sugar? You must add something. You have to add something sweet to that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I do add.
Now, and there was, in Italy, there's a traditional day to make it.
Oh,
like
interesting.
Like St. George. There's something in
I've
June.
Read
I don't know
that.
If Michael can look it up. I don't like St. George Day, something along those lines.
Right.
Because Ridgely Evers and Colleen McGlynn, who have Davero in some of the early years when they're having their harvest party, they would have made nocino on that day in June.
Oh, nice.
And then they would give it to people who came to the party in November. It was very sweet.
What a lovely tradition.
Yeah, but it's a very specific date. And yes, Mike's going to look it up for us.
And so that's really one of my favorites. And very often when people come to the tasting room, they'll have some obscure fruit in their backyard, and sometimes it works out magically. And
so they'll bring it to you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, what are some of the stranger things?
Absolutely. A fruit that I just discovered this year, which I never thought of, is a... Japanese dogwood. The Japanese dogwood, the flowering tree. And this actually wasn't something that someone brought to the winery. It was something I actually have had in my backyard flowering outside my kitchen window for 12 years every year. It does its beautiful blossoming thing. And then in fall, it has these big raspberry-like looking fruits, which have they're not soft like a raspberry. It has this tough, leathery. And people all these years have been saying, oh, is that edible? It looks so edible. And I'm like, no, it's not edible. And then I was looking at it this year and I thought, well, is it edible? Of course, not wanting to poison myself, I decided to go and actually research this. And it turns out that it actually is edible. The red part isn't. It's like leather. It's
so
not
it's like something
at all.
Inside?
When you crack it open, there's this little... orange mango-ish paste on the inside of the Japanese dogwood fruit.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
What's it taste like?
It's a mix between mango and orange.
How interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'd love to see what would happen with mangosteen. Have you ever had a mango?
No.
Mangosteen is probably the best fruit I've ever had. I found some in New York a few weeks ago, but they were so far past their prime. If you didn't know what a mangosteen was, you wouldn't have understood. But when I was in Malaysia studying peppercorns, I saw that I was in Chinatown in Kuala Lumpur, and there was a cart. The only thing he had was this huge pile, and it's very leathery. It sort of looks like a persimmon, the flat persimmon with the the four leaves, except it's deep purple, and it's the texture of a pomegranate.
Huh.
And I'm looking at it, and the guy cut one open, and on the inside of the skin is this icky, gooey, deep purple pulp that stains your fingers. And then sitting inside of that is this perfect off-white fruit. And if you get it at the right time, it has sections like a tangerine, but the membranes between the sections aren't really there yet. And the seeds, there's a seed in each membrane, but those are fairly immature.
Uh-huh.
And you bite into it. And it's not crunchy like an apple. But it still has a little resistance. And it has a flavor. Oh, my God. Like a combination of strawberries, rhubarb, and the best white peach you have ever tasted. It is extraordinary.
Of course, I want to try that one immediately.
Yes. Well,
That sounds like the sort of thing that would really make a lovely...
Yeah. Well, Jeff Dawson, if you knew Jeff Dawson, who had Grandview Farms, he bought some property... Gosh, it must be in about 2000 on Hawaii Moku, Big Island of Hawaii, and he planted 3 or 4 mangosteen trees, and it takes 9 years for them to fruit, so he should be fruiting now.
Wow.
I have found the Maisonova and mango grove in north of Hilo, but it's because there's so much rain on that side of the island, and they need a drought to flower.
Interesting.
And by drought, they need 3 weeks without rain to flower. And so really, the Hilo side of the island is not quite the place. But if I can ever find any mangosteen for you, I will.
That will be interesting. Yeah. I try to stick with sort of local fruits, but that one sounds like it might be worth venturing outward for.
Yeah, it's so interesting.
It sounds like Natino is associated with the eve of St. John's Day, which is June 24th.
That sounds about right.
But actually, it was from the Picts, and it was a solstice drink.
Oh.
And the Romans adopted it, and then when the Romans adopted Christianity, they had to make some sort of a religious holiday, so they associated it with St. John.
That is fascinating. Thank you so
great.
Much for looking that up.
How cool.
Whoa.
So we are, believe it or not, almost out of time.
Darn.
We got 3 minutes. That's a long time in radio. So one of the things we want to do is get people to your website.
Definitely. That is SonomaAperitif.com.
And spell aperitif for newbies to the concept.
It's A-P-E-R-I-T-I-F.
There you go. Aperitif. And you can join a wine club.
You can join
100, 250, 500.
Exactly.
And for the person who called and wanted to know how they got the condiments, you get the condiments right now by joining the wine club. And then when do you think you will be available for retail sales?
I'm actually available right now because had my
labels approved
for grapefruit, quince, and pear.
Oh, cool. And so people can go to the website, get the phone number that way?
They can, exactly.
And then
they can come taste at the winery.
Cool. And then they can buy.
I'm not shipping anywhere yet right now.
Okay.
But.
And then what sort of sales do you think you will have? Do you think most of your sales will be from the tasting room, or do you think you'll get somebody to carry it?
I initially thought that most of my sales would be from the tasting room.
Mm-hmm.
And I've really sort of been laying low and not doing any type of marketing while I waited for the labels
sure,
to come through.
That makes sense.
But there's been a lot of interest from restaurants because of the whole sort of cocktail craze that's going on right now.
Mm-hmm.
restaurants that only have a beer and wine license are feeling a little left out of this.
Oh, sure.
And the thing about this type of cocktails is that it kind of combines the nuance of wine with kind of the infinite flavor palette of cocktails.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're intrigued by that, and I think it's an interesting option to offer their guests.
Cool. So maybe there as well.
Yeah. So definitely restaurants.
Okay, cool. And on that note, we'll just run through it again. Laura Hager Rush, who also happens to work here at KRCB and is a fine graphic artist and does great book review or did great book reviews. It is Sonoma Aperitif at SonomaAperitif.com. There you go. And on that note, I think we're out of here. It's been a mouthful. It's been a great, great, delicious hour. It's so good. So meet me back here next week for another episode of the Wine Country's Most Delicious Hour. Mouthful here on KRCB.
Children, it is plain but true. God knows if a preacher preaches long enough.
Mouthful, the Wine Country's Most Delicious Hour, is produced and hosted by Michelle Anna Jordan, who also selects Mouthful's music. Live episodes are engineered by Michael Young and occasionally by Mary Moore Campagna. Mark Fuller is Mouthful's recording and post-production engineer. Podcasts are available at iTunes and krcb.org. For more information, to suggest a guest, and to find out how to be a guest yourself, email catsmilk@sonic.net or send a message via Mouthful's Facebook page.